Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, joined by my executive director, Josh Wood. And today we are going to give you a bit of a recap of what we've been up to for the last week or so, namely several days in London with some of the top political leaders, philosophical leaders, artists, and cultural drivers across the Western world, all focused on cultural renewal for the sake of reviving Western civilization. So we're going to talk with you a little bit about ARC, the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, the conference that we were at in London. But first, as always, we're going to start with a little bit of Bible time. One of the other highlights in my life over the last week is that my husband is home. He joined the Navy as an active duty chaplain. And so he's been gone the better part of the last 6 months. But for the last week, we've been able to be together. So spent some time walking, talking, reading. We play a lot of cards and reading scripture together. And the scripture that is most on his mind right now is Psalm 91, which is something that has been embraced by and relied upon among our men in uniform for decades. And it makes a lot of sense because it talks about all kinds of terrors, all kinds of threats, all kinds of dangers, and God protecting you from it. So I pulled out a few of the verses that he was saying were especially dear to the men that he was leading. And Psalm 91, 5 through 7 says, "You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you." And then it goes on to say, "Because you've made the Lord your dwelling place, the Most High, who is my refuge, no evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague come near your tent." Now, it's interesting because I read this and I asked my husband, I said, what's the line here between like believing these promises and sort of the name it, claim it prosperity gospel of I declare that no sickness is going to come near you and no arrow is going to like pierce you. And like, where is the line there? And he just said, "I'm just going to believe this by faith and my life is in God's hands." And I thought, you know, this reveals a bit of a weakness in my life where sometimes I pray too safely. Sometimes I pray only in ways where I think it's probably going to happen anyway. I don't necessarily ask for big or daring things all of the time. I tend to ask for things that I think, well, if it doesn't happen, then God won't be embarrassed. And I think that's a problem. I think that scripture models for us, and even the great Christians throughout history have demonstrated that you can be unrealistic in what you ask for God of. And a lot of times he does deliver on those wild, wild requests, wild for the sake of his kingdom requests. And it was just a bit of a rebuke to me to say, I don't need to figure out what makes sense, what's probably going to happen. I don't need to kind of weigh the scales in terms of whether or not this is something that's going to really happen or not. I just need to say, full trust, full confidence in you, Lord, and then reaching for the stars in terms of my request. And then, you know, like my husband says, put my faith in God's hands and let him do what he will. Josh, any thoughts on sort of that mix between faith and name it, claim it, or just in terms of God's protection for us in general?
Yeah, I heard a quote that said something like, "The beauty of faith is that it doesn't make sense. The maddening part of faith is that it doesn't make sense, but the hopeful part of faith is that it doesn't make sense." I kind of get that. There's some of that that we just don't really know. Is it that we shouldn't fear those things because they're not going to come for us, or that they don't have the final say? Yeah, it's hard to tell. And for some, things will, you know, come against us that we don't survive here on earth. And for others, it will be, you know, like it almost makes me think of, not that I'm, again, this is used by Trump apologists sometimes, that God saved him. But there is something in even that attack, his assassination attempt, where you're like, man, that just feels like God kind of intervened. And does that mean that he's a perfect person? No, obviously Donald Trump is not. But it is kind of hard to deny that there are certain moments where it feels like God does shield someone. And maybe that's for the benefit of all of this country and all the things that other people are going to do through this administration. I don't know. But yeah, it's just kind of like Christ as mystery. You know, it's something we can't wrap our head around and say, man, God is in control. And in some ways, I don't understand it, but it's hard to deny it at the same time.
Yeah, there are cosmic ledgers that we don't necessarily get to see the figures for. And I think that's probably some of where I fall short is I'm looking too much at the immediate. I'm thinking too much about the economy, the world economy that is so tangible without thinking about the spiritual economy, the spiritual kingdom that Christ came to establish. And so I probably need to get myself, my mindset, even my prayer life out of the immediate and into the eternal. And that's probably the perspective that I need to be having more of. So Josh and Jen Friesen, our training director, joined me in London the week before last for the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. This is a conference, a movement that is seeking to, in essence, revive Western civilization. Oz Guinness is one of the chairmen, one of the board members, and also a prominent player. And he talks a lot about how there's been mighty civilizations that have arisen all throughout history, and then they end up declining, and then they end up disappearing. And they all sort of face this cultural precipice where they're right on the edge and they have to decide, are they going to revive the great story that allowed them to rise to that level and degree of prominence? Are they going to replace the story with something better, or are they going to decline? And that is the question that faces us in the West today. What is the story that got us to the point where we created civilizations all across Europe, the UK, Australia, the United States? I would actually say every place that the British Empire touched, Singapore, Japan in many ways, you know, has been an inheritor of a lot of these benefits as well. Korea, South Korea, everywhere that these Western ideals have gone, we have seen the greatest degree of human flourishing, freedom, thriving, economic growth, standards of living that have risen, health, birth rates that have gone up. I mean, all of those different things are going to be the product of the story that we have told in the West. Now, obviously, that story is grounded in Christianity. They are inseparable. And so we are looking through the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. This is something that was started by Jordan Peterson. He's probably the most notable of the major founders and figureheads. And then a couple other British leaders as well, where they said, we want to counter the anti-human, anti-free market, anti-elitist perspective of, you know, organizations like the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, all these sort of global conglomerates that are aiming away from human flourishing and, unfortunately, too often pressing down ideological constraints on a population to their detriment. So that's what we've been a part of, right? I'm on the advisory board for the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. We had a booth on the exhibition floor. We got to host one of the dinners around fortifying and strengthening the social fabric. And I will just say it was an absolute delight of a week, mainly because it pulled together 4,000 delegates from about 90 different countries. And in the stream of people who are working on marriage and family, you had some of the most pure-hearted, hardworking, devoted, and diligent people from all across the world. There together to say, how is it that we can fortify and reinforce the family? So it was a huge, wonderful, joyous week for me. Josh did a better job of getting in on some of the sessions and hearing the speakers. So Josh, what were some of your highlights of that time in London?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, there's all these different topics, right? Energy, foreign policy. They talked about, big government, big tech. They talked, all these different things. And family was one of them. And it was interesting to me that everyone had, those topics that they found interesting, like maybe energy or drilling or AI. but almost everyone had a stake in the family portions. I felt like during those, it's that was almost like a unifying thing. Some people care about tech, but oil came up and they're like, I don't know. I mean, I get it. But when it came to family, how we form them, what's important, how our kids are being taught, how they're being raised, what it means, marriage, what that means to our society, how kids are best set up to flourish, to grow up and become productive, innovative citizens. Everyone cared about that. It was like a unifying thing. And so I took a special, you know, heart in that that's our place in this, you know, sector too, is we want to contribute meaningfully there. And I think one plank that we hold and one thing that we carried into it was that kids need moms and dads. They need to be raised by their mother and father. That's critical. And when you get that right, so much of these other things flow downstream from that. A couple of the sessions I found extremely interesting. One was it was a speaker from England who was talking about kids and talking about technology. I think it was Sophie, I'm going to get her last name wrong, Winkleman maybe. She was talking about how they're pushing to get tech out of schools completely. That in almost all cases, kids don't do better when they get these digital third parties, intermediaries separating them and children, or them and teachers. And I thought that was so brilliant. I mean, she gave all these stats that we've essentially been lied to. It's like a tech mirage that when you bring that into schools, when you bring that into the classroom, into their pockets, they become self-conscious. They become, you know, unhelpfully self-aware of everything going on around them. They don't learn as well. They don't connect with others. They don't connect with teachers. And it's not clear that they learn better either.
Well, it's interesting to me that your observation is that most of the people responded to the social fabric portion. And that makes sense to me. And because like you said, there's five streams that we tend to focus on, like identity in terms of like the digital world, and energy, environment, governance, and then social fabric, you know, which is family formation primarily. And a lot of those other ones, you know, like tech, like there was a speech by Eric Weinstein that is like one of the smartest guys anywhere on the planet. And he was talking about like the suppression of, you know, development of new physics philosophies and how, you know, they're prohibiting us from being able to like sail into the stars. And I'm like, I don't doubt that this boy knows what he's talking about. But it didn't connect with me at all, just because like that I'm outside of that realm. It's so intangible for me. And it's honestly the same thing with energy. Like, I'm at the point now where I know enough to be like, if you're not talking nuclear, you're not really serious about both environment and energy, like doing both of them. But I don't know much beyond that. But the thing about family is it's something that we all are intimately familiar with, whether it went very well for us as a child or went very poorly for us as a child. That is something that everybody has firsthand experience on, either for your great benefit or your great detriment. And so to me, it does make sense that that is the thing that people most respond to, because when you can speak truth about these unchanging human realities, you will prick the heart. And hopefully we're going to prick the heart for the sake of the good and for the sake of knitting together, knitting back together the social fabric that has been fraying across the Western world.
Well, that's one of the brilliant parts about both God's design and about natural law is you don't need a PhD in quantum physics to see a child taken from their mother and say, ah, that's not right. I don't agree with that. Or you don't, you know, to see a kid abandoned. I mean, I was thinking about in Western North Carolina after the hurricane, there were these terrible stories about these children walking around searching for their parents because they had been washed away by the flood, barefoot in the forest. And it's just, you go, that's awful. I can't think of anything worse than that. Well, we just kind of know, why is that bad? Hey, why can't that kid be just transported into any other two loving parents? Well, because it's an incredible, irreplaceable, irreversible loss that you can only mitigate the rest of their life, not ever fully redeem. And again, I like that because it just goes to show you don't need these advanced degrees to know that this is what kids need.
Well, ARC was fantastic. You'll be hearing more about it. We're going to do another conference in about a year and a half, so stay tuned. In our next segment, we're going to hit some of the major political and cultural news, from Elon Musk fathering his 13th child to the Trump executive order that supposedly is going to make IVF more accessible and more low cost. So stay with us for that.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back on Them Before Us Radio. This is Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, and Josh Wood, executive director of Them Before Us. And there has been a lot happening in the space of marriage and family on the national level. Probably the one that is been reverberating the most around the hallways of my digital timeline is Trump issued an executive order to expand IVF, to expand in vitro fertilization. So, Josh, tell us a little bit about what the White House said in terms of this new executive order.
Well, if you've been on social media at all, you've noticed people saying promises made, promises kept. That's been the mantra of the first month of the Donald Trump presidency, is things he said on the campaign trail he would do are now being fulfilled, or at least they're starting down that road now. And so if we circle back all the way to the middle of the campaign, a group of judges, the Supreme Court in Alabama says an embryo is a person. And this was in response to someone who wandered into a freezer, picked up a couple vials and dropped them and killed multiple embryos that were encased in this frozen dry ice. And from there was this cascade of fear and talking points that came, where people were saying IVF is now no longer going to be able to exist, because if we can't treat embryos as non-persons, then we can't do IVF. Well, Katie, having followed you for years, even before I worked here, I never thought IVF would be front page news. You know, but you've been on this subject forever, talking about, you know, basically educating. What's the 101 on IVF? Because so few people know about it. And that's what I want to believe is going on here, even with the White House. There was this instinctual desire, this knee-jerk desire to respond to what happened in Alabama to say, we're for life. And IVF on the surface looks like it's producing life. And so we have to protect the process that's helping mom and dad who want to have a kid, have a kid. We got to protect that. Now, I also am optimistic to say that once people know about IVF, once they understand what this really is, that they'll be more hesitant and they'll call out some of the abuses. But this executive order essentially said, we need to expand access to this process. We need to understand how to make it more affordable, and we welcome people's input, and I want a policy proposal from my administration soon. And that's basically what it said. And so, again, at Them Before Us, we have an opinion on this, and we want to tell people about what IVF is, and we think if we can just get people the information, they will make better decisions. But this topic is so clouded in secrecy because of the industry that many people don't really know what they're advocating for when they say, man, IVF needs to become a right.
Yeah, so what the executive order wanted to do was two things: expand access and reduce cost, because IVF is expensive, anywhere from $12,000 to $25,000 to do one round of in vitro fertilization, one round of making babies in glass. And it costs a lot of money. And obviously, it's a barrier to access for a lot of people that want to create children this way. Our response is the same response we have to any cultural, legal, or technological development that victimizes children. And that is, do not do this. Not only should it not be done, but we should not have government subsidizing it. We should not have insurance company partially paying for this. Why is that? Because our best estimate that only about 2.3% of children created in vitro will be born alive. The vast majority of children created in a laboratory are going to die in the process. They will be sex selected out of existence. They will be graded out of existence. They will be screened out of existence because of supposed genetic abnormalities, or they'll be frozen forever. Unfortunately, this is a very anti-life, anti-child technology if you believe that life begins at conception, which is the biologically correct perspective on the origins of life. So my friend Callum Miller, who's a pro-life leader in the UK, said, I believe, you know, I love my friends created through IVF. I just wish I could have met all their siblings too. And that's the right take. You know, for every one child that you see born through IVF, statistically, there's 18 or 19 that you will never meet, either because they didn't make the grade or they simply didn't meet the specifications of adults. So interestingly, Josh, you mentioned the huge kerfuffle over IVF a year ago when the Alabama Supreme Court decision came down, and we saw a circling of the wagons by a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives, and even some pro-lifers saying, oh, we have to protect IVF. It is a mere 12 months later. And after the executive order, you had major conservative organizations like the Family Research Council critiquing this. You had almost uniform condemnation, or at least caution, issued by all of the major pro-life groups. To me, it looks like even just in the last 12 months, there has been an impact of the education on how IVF, while it does produce some lives, those little, even the ones that it does produce, many times they're treated like a eugenics project. So even the children that do survive often pay a serious price for being created through these kinds of processes. So there's a lot more work to do. I the executive order itself didn't have a lot of teeth to it. It was sort of, like you said, an opportunity to say promises made, promises kept. But I do hope in that 90-day window where they are gathering feedback, the end result is going to be, we love babies, and actually we would rather figure out how we can heal people from infertility rather than circumventing natural fertility through these anti-child technologies.
Yeah, that's two things. If you are on this, listening to this show, and you want to know more, go to thembeforeus.com or just Google thembeforeus IVF. You will go straight to our page. You'll understand. We oppose things, anything we've listed out in our statement. We oppose any process that treats to abort embryos, to discard embryos because they're the wrong gender. We oppose the perpetual freezing of embryos, frozen in time at day five of life, of which there's probably close to 2 million in the U.S. right now. We list out all of the different practices within IVF. That way, when your friends say, why are you against IVF? You can go and say, well, anyone should be opposed to any process that removes one gender, tries to select for hair color, that freezes people forever, that does pre-genetic testing to screen out disease that's incredibly unreliable, leading to all kinds of false positives. So go to our website. You can get all the information for yourself. Again, I believe strongly that as Christians, technology is challenging our beliefs on life, and we have to update our apologetics. It is incumbent on us, and when our daughters go through infertility, when we struggle with it ourselves, to have good, faithful answers, to have thought well about these issues. It's on us to be the expert. So go to our website. You can learn more about this there.
Yeah. And why should you be an expert? Because children need you to come to their defense. They cannot speak for themselves. They cannot advocate for themselves. They don't do radio shows. They don't speak at conferences. They don't appear on interviews, on major platforms with people that want to know the truth about this. They cannot do this themselves. It is you, Christian mom and dad, who have to rise to their defense. And you can't do that if you don't have the information. So we hope to be a resource for you on that. So that's kind of what was happening in the legal realm, in the executive realm. But there was also a huge explosion in my ex feed when, about a week ago, it was on Valentine's Day, conservative commentator Ashley St. Clair, who's 31 years old, announced that she was the mother of Elon Musk's 13th child. Elon, that we know of, has 13 children by four different women, largely through IVF. His first wife, they had six children together. The first, I believe, was conceived naturally, but died of SIDS very, very early. And then they had two different rounds of IVF, resulting in a set of twins and a set of triplets. He then went on and had a set of twins and then another child, I believe, with another woman, last name Zillis. Then a couple of years later, an influencer named Grimes had his second, two or three more children. And then Ashley St. Clair is the most recent mother of his children. And there was a bit of a controversy here because Ashley St. Clair is on the right. She is a supposed social conservative. She's very GOP aligned. She's beautiful. And so it was a bit bewildering, I think, for a lot of the conservative influencers to see this woman announced that she is a single mother to the richest man in the world. And it's very clear that they are not going to get married and have a happy home together. I mean, the day that she announced her motherhood of his child, he was out meeting the Indian prime minister with the second mother of his children. So, you know, I have called this modern day polygamy. Like, really what he's doing is he's creating, for the same reasons that Old Testament patriarchs and even modern day polygamists created families through multiple women for the sake of, you know, displaying their status and you know, showing how wealthy they are and increasing their progeny. I mean, he has sort of said, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to have as many children as possible. And it's been nice in some ways to see him talking about the importance of his children and bringing his son to the White House. I just wish, as Brad Wilcox has noted, I just wish that he recognized how much his children need marriage, how much his children need him to be married to the mother of, to their own mother. And he's not. And as a result, those kids are going to be disadvantaged.
Well, there's obviously a good desire in wanting to create life and to want, again, it's a natural desire to want to see your children and to see them grow up. And I think what we would say is that can't come at the expense of a child's right to be raised by you. And so when you do this with five or six women, again, you're doing something that so many of us have enjoyed ourselves, which is the desire to build a family and the desire to hold our own children in our arms. But marriage, like you said, is the institution that not only binds them to you, but you to them. It gives them you all the time to be present, and especially as a dad, to be there for them, especially through these key ages, these young ages where they need you most. And so I think he's ultimately, in my eyes, and we can get to the response part from the right in a second, but in my eyes, he's taken and as so much so often happens, he's taken a good desire and he's really now taken it and made the child pay for him to be able to continue to pursue that end, where his children are now going to get just at best, a fraction of his time. And that is unjust. They should have more.
That's exactly right. First of all, he is right. His instincts that we need more children, not less, is absolutely correct. We are facing a population implosion coming our way. 70% of people today across the globe live in countries that are not replacing themselves in terms of total fertility rate. Elon sees this and understands it. And his solution is have lots of babies. So he has diagnosed the problem correctly. And he knows the solution partially. But the solution is not to make as many babies as possible with any variety of women. The solution is to have lots of babies within a committed marriage, because those children will not grow up to be well-formed if they are growing up apart from their father. And I had this conversation with Emily Jashinsky on Unheard a couple days ago, where Elon Musk, you know, one of his oldest living children is a transgender woman. That is, Xavier decided to identify as Vivian and has, you know, publicly denounced her father, distanced herself from his father, I should say. Elon Musk has talked about how painful that was to him, how he lost his son to what he calls the woke mind virus. Yes, that's all very true. But why is it that children become so susceptible to these LGBTQIA identities? And it is because they very often, they have insignificant identity formation within the home. If you cannot ground yourself in an identity that has to do with your own mother and father, your kinship, that network, that stability, you will search for an identity somewhere and the world is happy to hand it to you in the form of a victimization in terms of a sexual minority. So I look at this and I say, yes, having more children is good. But do you think that all of these 13 children who are going to grow up, like you said, Josh, with a fraction, with crumbs of what they deserve from their father in terms of attention and connection, that is not the way to go. We don't want to simply repopulate the earth. You know, we want to have children according to what God says in Malachi chapter 2. Why did he make the two one flesh? In flesh and spirit, they are his. Why? What was that one God seeking? And the answer is godly offspring. He didn't just want offspring. He wants godly offspring. That requires the two becoming one and staying together. Why? It's hard to create godly offspring without mother and father parenting together in the same home, loving one another and loving the child every day. So I worry that these children of his are going to be susceptible to a variety of different social pitfalls because they are being malnourished in terms of their attention from their father.
And we should recognize that culture has never been more after our kids, more They've never had more access to our kids through TV, through phones, screens, friends, teacher, you know, at school, unfortunately. So you almost need to be more present than ever. And in addition to, you know, the just the normal identity crisis of going through life. On the other hand, this response, I think my word to conservatives and Christians maybe specifically, because maybe political parties exist to win elections, right? So they may have to change with the tides. Christians don't have to do that. And I would just caution us that we do really ruin our witness. And I think the vast majority of people will respect us more when we call balls and strikes, no matter who's wearing the jersey. If a Republican does something wrong, call it out, a Democrat the same way. And I think we'll get more trust that way.
Agree. If you want all of my thoughts on that, I wrote a column at World Magazine called The Cost of Conservative Hypocrisy, which did point out that a lot of these major conservative platforms have no problem congratulating Ashley St. Clair or Dave Rubin, who with his husband created two motherless children through surrogacy. They congratulate those people, but they don't congratulate their political rivals, such as Pete Buttigieg, when they create two children who are motherless, or the variety of people on the left who come out with alternative family forms. To steel man the case, they're saying, well, we just love babies. We're just happy that this baby was born. And yet they are not offering the same kinds of congratulations when somebody else gives birth to a baby or that baby is born. So like you said, Josh, my opinion is we cannot squander the political capital or the credibility that we have, especially with the next generation, by not being clear that we love babies, but not all birth announcements are created equal. Some of them really deserve to be praised, and some of them need to be carefully critiqued. Stay with us. We'll be back with your Q&A in just a minute.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. We are going to tackle some of your questions that you have sent in through the week. We love hearing from you. So if you want to have your questions answered on air, please send them to us. I am here with Jen Friesen, our training director, who grabs, collates, and prepares these every week. And she's going to pitch some of them to us and also give us some of her insight into some of these really challenging questions, sort of where culture and technology meet for the most part. So, Jen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Katie. Hi, everyone. Good to be back this week. Really interesting questions that are kind of spanning both some parenting stuff and technology this time. First question is, when you live in a dominant progressive culture, this person might know that we live in the Seattle area, how can Christian parents raise their kids with traditional values without feeling like you're isolating them from their peers and community?
It is tricky business, that child rearing, whether you're doing it in a red state or a blue state, whether you're homeschooling, private schooling, or public schooling your kids. This is not something that any Christian parent can simply go into unthinking anymore. You really do need to be deliberate. You really do need to have a mapped out philosophy of how to instill your worldview in your children in age-appropriate ways as they grow. That is one reason why Stacey Manning and I wrote our second book called Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, where we talk about how we have done it with our collective seven children in terms of, you know, what did we do in elementary school, middle school, and high school? So the summary of our answer to that question is, you do need to be careful about what you allow them to be exposed to, especially in the elementary school years. During that phase of learning, what classical educators would call the grammar phase, they don't have the ability to critically think through what they're being presented. They cannot filter out. They don't have the capacity to filter out truth from lies or beauty from vulgarity. And so you have to be the filter for them. So really in elementary school, you are sheltering them from the distortions, right? Distorted depictions, body images, or graphic violence, or certainly sexual relationships or sexual depictions that go against the good, true, and beautiful of God's design for sex. And so you do want to be very careful about the media you expose them to, the movies that you watch, and certainly what they're being exposed to online. But then after that, you want to, our opinion is, introduce them to the distortions. You know, that's the point in middle school, the logic phase of learning, where the switch gets flipped in their brain and they're no longer just memorizing and regurgitating what you've told them. They now say, but how do you know that's true? But what if you're wrong? That is your indication that it is time to go all in on what we call the great equipping. You now equip them to confront all of those dangerous, progressive, or woke ideas that might be coming to them through school or through social media or even through their friends. So we think that you can do this. We know that you can do it. We've done it. We have other friends that have done it as well. Regardless of whether or not you live in a culture that's more or less hospitable to the Christian ideas, you are the primary educator with the right kind of calibration and with age-appropriate training. You can raise children who not only, you know, withstand the gale force wind of progressivism, but who are able to push back against it. You can actually use that cultural friction to sharpen their worldview. So if that's your question, you know, I highly recommend raising conservative kids in a woke city where we offer resources, we offer really practical advice on how to do this at every age and stage. And the result is, you know, kids who are able to navigate the world on their own with confidence.
That's good. And Katie, from what you've and Stacy shared in that book and things I've picked up from you, I was chatting with a friend who was talking about some swim lessons or something for a kid, and they thought that there might be a they-them leading the swim lessons. And so the friend was kind of concerned, how am I going to navigate this with my kid? What if they try to push it on them? And we were chatting a little bit about that idea of being, when the parent is the first one to introduce something, a concept. And you know how little kids, like you're saying, in that first stage, they're so willing to be like, my mom and dad said, you can't wear your shoes in the house, right? It's like everything is about they're helping with that black and white ruling. And I said, what would it be like if you've had these conversations? And when the person says, my pronouns are blah, 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 what are your pronouns? And the kid says, my mom and dad said, that's inappropriate to ask me. Or my mom and dad said, you can only be a man or a woman. And if someone was to ask me that, that's being inappropriate and I should tell them right away. You just can like equip your kid. First of all, it also communicates to that person, this isn't someone to play around with or mess around with trying to push that ideology on, because now the kid is already aware and the parent is going to be aware. Because I think a lot of that thrives in the ability to kind of keep it in darkness and, oh, at school, you can transition and your parents won't know. And it's like, that's not going to happen when the parent has already equipped the kids to be on the lookout for it, right?
I know that a lot of you guys aren't necessarily dealing with what kids in Seattle public schools are, but it was, I believe, early last year when Stacy's youngest, Miles Manning, was a fifth grader and walked into his classroom and there was a substitute teacher. It was very clearly a man with prosthetic breasts and a wig trying to look like a woman. Miles walked in, looked at the teacher, walked straight out, went straight to the principal's office and said, call my mother. She will not approve of a man dressed as a woman teaching me today. She will come pick me up. And Mrs. Manning did. And I believe the school issued an apology. But obviously, some people are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you even put your kid in a situation like that. Guess what? The situations are coming for your child, whether they're in real life or in digital form. So just equip your child to identify it and not to go along with it. Mm-hmm. Miles didn't feel like he had to walk up to the teacher and like argue with him. He just said, no. The answer is no. I know enough to be like, no, and I'm getting out of here. Perfect. Yeah. That's exactly what you want kids in those elementary school years to know. Just like you said, Jen, they have this very rigid thinking. Like, work with it. Exploit that rigid thinking. Build in the good, true, and beautiful to a place where they understand this is right, this is wrong, and this is how I know that I can respond in this situation right now.
Right. Well, and I love that story too, because he knew 100%. Mom, lion mom is backing me on this. Like, I'm not getting in trouble. You know, when kids know the school doesn't have more authority for me than my mom and dad do, I know they will protect me, back me up, whatever. That's huge. Okay, next question. With the rise of AI and genetic engineering, should we, children's rights advocates, support or oppose technologies that allow parents to select embryos based on intelligence or other traits? You know, assuming in a future we'll be able to just do all this. Is this really that different from screening for disease?
It is screening for disease, and that's still a problem. I mean, anytime a human is going to take the who lives and who dies question into their hand, which is exactly what's going on in the world of embryo creation. I mean, the reason why IVF, as we talked about in the first segment today, the reason why IVF is responsible for probably four times as many deaths every year of embryonic life compared to Planned Parenthood, compared to abortion, is because we're not making one or two embryos, we're making 20. And then among those 20, we're going to decide the one or two that we implant, the 2 to 4 that we freeze, and the rest that are going to get discarded or destroyed or donated to research. And so we are in this place where we are choosing who lives and who dies. That's what's going on in IVF right now. When it comes to AI, when it comes to all of these different interventions, and let's be clear about what's going on right now. All of these questions that we're dealing with, AI, IVF, same-sex marriage, abortion, end-of-life, you know, euthanasia-style maid, death with dignity, blah, 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 all these things that are, all of them have something in common, and it ultimately comes down to the question, what does it mean to be human? Who decides who lives and who dies, right? That's a question of what it means to be human. Are we male or female, or is there more options than that? And if we're male and female, what does that say about the nature of marriage? And if those male and female attributes are inherent, then we can't transition from male to female. So all of these questions, we first have to ground in the answer of what does it mean to be human? And to be human means that you are a mind-soul unity. You are both of those. And many of the modern technologies are going to downgrade, disregard, or bifurcate those two things, right? They're going to try to separate or diminish the nature of what it means to be human. And so AI is doing that, right? AI is, in essence, in many ways, a soul or a mind without a body. And so it's an inhuman technology that is going to inform, that is trying to inform how humans live. So that is a long way of saying, first, you have to understand what it means to be human. You're a mind-soul unity. You're a body-soul unity. Your body is genuinely a part of who you are. Your mind and your soul is also truly a part of who you are. And you have got to live faithfully within that mind-body unity in terms of understanding that you don't make life and you don't take life. You don't screen life. You don't dispose of life. You don't donate life to research. Like, I honestly think that, you know, John Stone Street will say, he's quoting somebody else that says, you know, if Christians are the ones who are known for not killing their children or their elderly, we will have done well. Okay. And that is what the Christian ethic says. It says, we know who we are. We know what we're made, how we're made, in whose image we are made. And therefore we are going to protect and we're going to treat differently both poles, both ends of the human experience. We are neither going to kill our young, nor are we going to snuff the old out of their life if they have dementia or a chronic illness, or if they're just severely depressed, or if they're taking too much money from the welfare system. So like, there's something about what it means to be human, specifically informed by the Christian worldview, that simply says, no, it doesn't matter what amount of AI we've developed or what kind of technologies we have at the front end or the back end of life. The answer is no. We don't kill innocents. We don't select them based on genetics. We don't discard them based on their sex. And we don't decide that it's no longer time for them to live because they cost too much money. The answer is no.
Yeah, that's so good. You know, in our IVF series that's going to be dropping in the next month or so, we interviewed a doctor who was talking about CRISPR technology, clipping out this and that. The problem is, when humans are trying to play God, we don't have the God ability to actually see the ramifications of every little decision that we're going to make. And he said, you know, you could clip out a predisposition to one kind of thing from the genes, and then it would cause them to be more predisposed to something else. And that's the difficulty with all the IVF stuff and whatever. We're deciding who lives and dies, and then people are coming into these ethical dilemmas. We weren't supposed to have 10 humans on ice that we had to decide, would we melt them and let them die, or try to implant them, or do we donate, quote unquote, donate them, and all these things.
You mentioned CRISPR. CRISPR is a gene editing technology that is, I mean, this is incredibly dangerous, because if you edit the genes of somebody who then is born alive, they will take that genetic editing, that mutation of their genes, into all of their offspring. So what you're actually doing is you're going to infuse the entire human population with an artificial edit. And like you said, you can think, oh, we're editing out this ability to carry the AIDS virus, but you don't know what other things you're also editing out. And the scientist in China who did that is named He Jian Kui, and he did this on two children in like 2018, edited their genes, spent 3 years in prison, has gotten out of prison. And just last week, 3 days ago, sent a picture of himself in front of a freezer and captioned, "Tinkering with human embryos will certainly be worth the risk."
Oh my gosh.
He is still at it. Like, we have got to be on high alert the way that we are trying to manipulate human life. I think we're all aware of the threats of aborting children, but you understand the risks of genetically editing children that are on the horizon. It's absolutely dystopic.
Yeah. All right. With your final minute, fast answer is, if we could do artificial wombs in the future, is this going to be an ethical alternative to surrogacy, or is this going to create more problems?
Good. My long answer is going to be found in an article called "Artificial Wombs Will Compound the Harm Reproductive Tech Inflicts on Children." I wrote that at Public Discourse about a year ago. And it's this idea. You've got people that are saying artificial wombs are going to be so great for preterm babies because then we'll be able to gestate them longer. We're going to be able to make sure that they live healthier lives. And that could be true. Some people will say artificial wombs are going to be great because then people with unwanted pregnancies can just transfer that baby to an artificial womb, and then it's her body, her choice, but the baby doesn't have to die. Here's the problem. In the baby assembly process, you need sperm, egg, and womb. Sperm is very easy to get to. We have lots and lots of it. Eggs are harder to get to, but we now have banks and catalogs where you can select the eggs that you want. Wombs are very hard to get to and very expensive to rent. So as much as big fertility can cut out that expensive portion of the baby assembly process, you know that they will. And very often it is the woman, the human female that is carrying the child, that actually protects them from a lot of the risks of big fertility, like selective reduction, where she is being encouraged or forced to abort one of the children. Oftentimes she's the one that feels so bonded and connected to the baby, even if the intended parents decide to abandon the child or reject the child. There's something about that bond between mother and child that they develop, even if they're not genetically related, that offers a level of protection that an artificial womb will not. So we, again, have to go back to this. Just because something is developing technologically, whether it's AI, whether it's the ability to screen babies, or whether it's artificial wombs, you can spin it as some kind of fantasy, like this is going to be good for humanity or good for the child. I guarantee you, artificial wombs are going to bring, if they're ever developed, are going to bring some of the most horrific kind of conditions for children. And that is if they survive. I don't actually know if you can gestate a human child in a machine, because children are made to have the movement, the different taste sensation of their mother's eating different kinds of food, the sounds of her voice, the rhythms of her walking and her waking and her talking. I actually don't know if babies would survive it.
Yeah, just how can you replicate a mom walking in the sun or feeling stressed or feeling calm or listening to music? And it's just impossible to get a robot to replicate what a human experiences.
Yeah, and it's inhumane for the child. Thanks for being with us. We hope that you feel better equipped to go into the world and defend kids. We'll see you here next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.